This is an interview with Jonathan Birks for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. This interview was recorded on July 27, 2012, at the Romney Campaign Headquarters in Boston, Massachusetts. James Stoker conducted the interview. John, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Happy to be here.
To start off these interviews, I usually like to ask people where they were born and where they grew up.
Sure. I was born in Columbia, Maryland, a suburb about halfway between Washington and Baltimore, but grew up in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, so about 2 hours north of D.C. Then I came back down to D.C. for college and never left.
And were you always interested in politics and policy?
Yeah. That was always the sort of thing that was the most interesting to me, and so I've always known that sort of Washington and government was where I wanted to, what I wanted to do.
Where did you go to college?
Georgetown University.
And what did you study there?
International politics. So I've always thought of myself as sort of more of a foreign policy and defense guy who keeps getting involved in economic policy and other issues. So.
Mm-hmm. So during college, did you study economics or economic policy or anything like that?
Yeah, the Georgetown's School of Foreign Service requires all their students to spend basically take a minor in economics, and I did a little bit more work just because I was interested in the subject.
Okay. So how did you start working for the Congress after college? How did you make that transition?
Sure. Sort of randomly, really. I was going to see my college professor, my academic advisor, and he asked what I was doing for the summer. I said I was looking for an internship, and he said, where? I said, on the Hill. He said, well, Republican or Democrat? Republican. And he picked up the phone and called a guy by the name of Mark Lagon, who at the time was Congressman Chris Cox's deputy staff director on the Republican Policy Committee. And so I started interning for the Policy Committee, and then ultimately they offered me a job at the end of the summer, and so I started working there in the fall of 1998.
What sort of things were you doing as an intern? Were you actually working on policy issues, or were you making photocopies?
A little bit of both, actually. Yeah. It was a great thing about the office. They really gave you an opportunity to do as much as you were capable of doing. So, I'd like to think I was, making grand policy pronouncements, but, there's mm-hmm. certainly a lot of making coffee and running errands, that sort of thing.
Did you work on financial issues at all at this time?
A little bit, primarily on sort of international trade and international export control kind of issues. So that stuff that had an economic component, but it wasn't purely economic.
Now, as an intern, did you have much access to the congressman himself, or?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the great thing about the Hill. The especially on the House side, members' offices are just so small that you really have a lot of opportunity to interact with the member.
Okay. Did you have any contact with the Securities and Exchange Commission at this time, or was that something separate?
A little bit later, once I was on staff, we did deal a bit with independent director rules and on accounting standards because, Congressman Cox had always been very interested in those issues. And so I did a little bit of work on those things. Other staff were the primary, but I, helped out as needed.
Okay. Had the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act already passed when you joined the Congress?
No, it was going on that summer. It was going on that summer, and then it passed, I guess, finally in 1999, I want to say. Yeah, that's right. I was on staff when it finally passed. But the interesting thing about Graham-Leach-Bliley, really, is that a lot of the hard work for it was really done in 1998, and it was pushed across the finish line in 1999. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those issues that Congressman Cox was on the conference committee that completed the bill, and so he was very involved. But I can't say I personally was very involved at that point.
Right. Okay. Another thing that happened while you were still there in the Congress in 2001, the House Committee on Financial Services was created. Were you there at the birth of that
sure.
committee?
Yeah, this was one of those interesting side effects of having had the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act passed, and an issue that really had a lot to do with personalities and sort of member politics. So at the time, jurisdiction over financial services issues were split between the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee. And so the idea was, we've created this new law to rationalize how we deal with financial services on the executive branch side. Shouldn't we do something similar on the legislative side? And so add on to that you had Mike Oxley and Billy Tozen both competing to become chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. And obviously two people can't be chairman simultaneously. And so the compromise that was reached by leadership was to expand the jurisdiction of the banking committee by adding the securities portfolio from Energy and Commerce and create what became the Financial Services Committee. And so there's obviously a lot of politics involved in members make their careers really on their committees. And so for someone like Congressman Cox, who had been a a securities lawyer in private practice and had been very interested in the Energy and Commerce Committee securities work, the idea that that jurisdiction was now going to a separate committee is sort of one of those jarring things for members to deal with. And so one of the compromises they reached was to, even though Energy and Commerce was an exclusive committee and Financial Services was now going to be an exclusive committee, they made some arrangements for some members to serve on both committees for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Was that split between Mike Oxley and, I guess, Billy Tozen, was that something that the staff was aware about at the time?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look back at the newspapers at the time, Roll Call or National Journal, there's a whole lot of discussion about who was going to be the next chairman of the Energy Committee. And it was one of those contests that really sort of energized members as far as fundraising for other members and doing campaign events for other members, so that you had a lot of energy going into this. And it was one of those issues that, because both members were viewed as solid and viewed as as good members, that you there was a lot of pressure for leadership to try to figure out a compromise.
So in 2001, you joined the White House staff. What was your position there?
Yeah, so at the beginning of the administration, I worked for Vice President Cheney as a special assistant for domestic policy, and so handled a variety of sort of grab bag of sort of minor issues, to be blunt, that other staff didn't want to handle. Mm-hmm. And then following the terrorist attacks of September 11, I took over as the deputy staff secretary and then eventually staff secretary to the vice president.
Okay. Just go back a little bit. Did you know Mr. Cheney before you started working in the vice president's office?
I didn't. I had met him once or twice because he had served on an advisory board that Congressman Cox had chaired. But I'd met him, but I didn't know him really.
Right.
My connection to that office really came from, again, from Congressman Cox. His chief of staff, Dean McGrath, became the vice president's deputy chief of staff. And so early in the administration, Dean asked if I was interested in coming across to the executive side, and I jumped to the opportunity.
Okay, great. Was Vice President Cheney interested in financial reform or financial issues particularly, or was that not something that was that got much emphasis within the office?
Well, it was something that was important to him. Obviously, the beginning of the administration, there was a lot of discussion around, eventually around Sarbanes-Oxley, and so that was definitely an issue that was important to him, and it was a major economic issue at the time, and he was very engaged on those issues.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. Now, you were working in the vice president's office when the problems at Enron started to emerge, right?
Yep.
Do you recall that being a major issue within that office, or was that handled elsewhere within the administration?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the vice president was engaged on it. I don't know there was a major issue as much as, obviously the first year in office, the vice president was very focused on sort of the energy task force and sort of developing an energy policy. And then obviously he's had a long history of being very engaged in national security issues. But, the nexus of sort of activity there was really on the NEC staff. But, the vice president's a member of the NEC and really was, obviously engaged, since this was, together with our tax, the tax cuts and with the development of the energy policy, this was the sort of third major economic policy issue going on in the administration.
Right. Were you consulting with the Congress on the law that or the bill that eventually became the Sarbanes-Oxley law?
Was I?
Well, yes, you personally, or the vice president's office in general.
Yeah, certainly, like I said, the vice president was engaged. I wasn't personally. It wasn't my area of responsibility. So
right. Okay. What about the formation of President Bush's 10-point plan for corporate accountability, which came out in March 2002? Was that something you guys were working on at all?
Yeah. By that point, I had moved into the staff secretary role for the vice president. And so one of the nice things about being staff secretary is everything comes across your desk, and you have a chance to sort of weigh in on everything.
Tell me about that position. What is your role there?
Yeah. So basically the idea is that if you're going to have a principal who has decision-making authority, you want to make sure that before documents, before decisions are presented to him, that you've got a fully considered and fair and balanced package of information presented to him on which to make that decision. And so the staff secretary really serves as that gatekeeper to both make sure the process has been completed and make sure that the documents and the decisions that are being presented are fully considered.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another issue for the Bush administration during these first few years in office was efforts to overhaul GSEs, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Were you involved in that at all?
Yeah, when I especially moved over to the chief of staff's office a couple of years later, we were very engaged in dealing with sort of GSE policy. You know, the GSEs are obviously a very political. Or at the time, were a very political issue. And it was one of those things that was a small group that worked on these issues and tried to ensure that we kept pretty tight message discipline and kept a very focused policy on how we dealt with the potential risks that these entities posed to the economy.
Right. So later on, there would be a little bit of criticism of the Bush administration. Some people would say, well, the Bush administration had been in office for 8 years and hadn't really done anything about GSEs. But what you're saying is that there really was an effort to try to overhaul those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look back, you know, there's several efforts in Congress to move legislation. And ultimately, you know, there wasn't a majority in Congress to act until after the financial crisis struck. But, you know, I think the administration, you look back at our budgets each year, you looked back at the legislative proposals, you know, the administration put forward the need for better regulation of these entities. You know, I think it's fair to say we didn't anticipate the scope of the financial crisis before it happened, but certainly recognized that this was a potential area of risk and wanted to improve regulation so that we could deal with that risk better.
Mm-hmm. During these years, there was also, a joint investigation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by the SEC and FAO, and investigating the accounting practice. There were allegations that they had smoothed earnings, and they eventually ended up settling for something like $400 million. Do you recall this being an issue in the Bush administration at this time? Is that something that you worked on?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, investigations, whether they're civil or criminal, are always handled, you know, arm's length from the White House so that you don't have political interference and that sort of thing. And so it was not a, you know, people were aware that there was an investigation ongoing because it had been publicly reported, but it was not something that the White House had any more information, frankly, than your average reader of the Wall Street Journal. So.
Okay. So from 2005 to 2007, you worked in the Office of International Affairs at the Department of the Treasury, right? What
Yes.
was your position there?
I was the senior advisor to the Undersecretary for International Affairs. Essentially, that meant I was the chief of staff for that 200-person office at Treasury that dealt with Treasury's international economics portfolio.
Okay. Can you tell me briefly how you ended up making the move to there from the White House?
Sure. During 2004, I'd been in the chief of staff's office working on sort of policy issues there. And I'd gotten to know Tim Adams, who at the time was the policy director on the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign. And so when Tim was nominated to be the Undersecretary for International Affairs, he called one day and asked if I'd be interested in coming over to Treasury with him. And so it seemed like a very interesting opportunity to get more in depth. You know, the problem with the White House is always that you're dealing with things that so many different things that you can only go so deep. And so this was a great opportunity to really get more in depth in a series of issues I was interested in.
Okay. So the Office of International Affairs, what did that office do exactly?
Yeah, so we had sort of two halves to the office, if you will. One half that dealt with sort of regional economic issues. You know, like today, they'd be very engaged on the European financial crisis. And then we also had a functional set of offices that dealt with issues like international banking or international investment and trade issues. And so the office really did provide both the manage the U.S. relationship with the international financial institutions, whether the IMF or the World Bank, and then also provided tried to provide sort of government-wide coordination, bringing together the independent regulators that are very active, obviously, on financial services domestically. Over time, that's become a much more internationally focused or internationally relevant set of issues. And so part of what we did was to try to bring together those regulators and try to coordinate positions so that the U.S. actually spoke with a you know, coherent voice in these international fora.
Right. So you were mostly dealing with other U.S. government agencies and trying to get them to speak, with a united voice instead of necessarily reaching out to other countries and dealing with other, the equivalent of the Treasury Department in different countries.
Yeah, certainly my role was more dealing with, internal to the U.S. as opposed to, but, you know, the office was obviously focused on bringing together all the different pieces of the U.S. government to speak mm-hmm. internationally, and we engaged regularly with our counterparts, you know, particularly Europeans and the Japanese and the Chinese increasingly.
But was it difficult to get them to speak with one voice?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, remember, each of these regulatory agencies has an independent charter, has a commission that is appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and has a statutory responsibility to execute, as they see fit. And so, you know, it's not a relationship where Treasury can dictate outcomes. It's very much one where through discussion, through analysis, we try to arrive at common positions.
Right. Okay. Did you find that other countries were sometimes maybe annoyed or a little bit irritated that the U.S. couldn't settle on one position on certain issues?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, whether it's U.S. companies, whether it's foreign companies or foreign countries, I think everyone can be a little frustrated with the fragmentation of the U.S. government. And, financial services is certainly one of those areas that's more fragmented than a lot of other areas of the U.S. government.
Okay. Well, what were some of the specific issues that you were working on during this period?
There was a lot of discussion, for instance, of international financial accounting rules. Mm-hmm. And so, that was one issue where the world obviously has been moving towards a common set of accounting standards. And, there's interest in the U.S. in moving in that same direction. But, of course, accounting standards are set through a, somewhat complex mechanism between the SEC and FASB. Mm-hmm. And so the ability of the U.S. to move to a more principles-based accounting standard isn't, our ability to move expeditiously in that direction is not not necessarily transparent. And then there's also just sort of prudential and statutory requirements about how we think about and how we approach accounting here in the U.S. And so there's a lot of issues to deal with there. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that was, actively under consideration at the time.
Were you engaged with the Congress at all on that issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, more so when I moved to the SEC in a couple of years, but certainly Congress has, especially after the Sarbanes-Oxley, has expressed a newfound interest in auditing and accounting standards. And so, Congress was interested, and that's definitely something that you always have to consider when you're mm-hmm. making policy in the U.S. government, how that affects.
What about the Basel capital requirements? Is
sure.
that something you were working on too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, Basel was at the time Basel II was in the offing, and there was anticipated that the U.S. would be implementing Basel II over the next couple of years, and so there's a lot of preparation work going on at the time. And of course, going back to sort of the fragmentation point, there's a lot of different banking regulators, so it was a time period where that was a very active issue. There was also a lot of interest and a lot of discussion about undergoing a financial sector assessment program, which was which we eventually did do in 2007, 2008, I think.
Who would have conducted that?
Well, the IMF had begun doing a program of these FSAPs. And the idea being that, looking at best practices, looking at how countries across the world could improve on the financial services regulation. And so it was one of those things where there was talk of whether the U.S. should do this, because we always, of course, are the gold standard for, financial regulation. But it sort of helped to encourage other countries to participate by the virtue of our agreeing to participate. And so that was one issue that, we were very active on at Treasury and, trying to convince the other regulators to agree that this would be a good idea and to agree that this would be something worth pursuing.
Were some regulators hesitant to do that?
Well, I think there's always hesitancy from the U.S. government sort of to submit ourselves to sort of international inspection, and I think that's a healthy reticence. But I think as we got more experience with how the IMF was conducting itself in other countries, I think it was useful in building confidence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. Now, was your office also working on issues of international cooperation as regards criminal investigations or perhaps investigating terrorist finance?
Yeah, we had a limited role there because, about maybe 2 years before I got to the Treasury Department, the International Affairs Office had actually been split. And so there was the International Affairs Office, which was focused on Treasury's international economics portfolio. And then we also had the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, which was focused on the money laundering, anti-terrorism financing issues. And so we still had a role to play, especially as the primary interlocutor with the IMF, which through its FATF process, or I should say FATF were separate, but through IMF standard setting and other international bodies, we had the primary responsibility for managing the Treasury relationship with these bodies. Mm-hmm. And so we continue to have a role in this, but really the driving force there was Stuart Levy, who was a national asset and just a tremendous amount of work that he and his shop did on making it harder for terrorists to finance themselves. So.
Okay. Then in February 2007, you started to work at the SEC as the director of the Office of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yep. And how did you end up moving to that post?
Well, by that point, my old congressman, Congressman Cox, had been appointed chairman. And basically in 2007, I was interested in sort of moving on from the Treasury Department. He got word of that, and one day I got a phone call asking if I'd be interested in coming over to chat. So I went over, we caught up for a while, and towards the end of the conversation, he's like, and I, got a couple of openings here on staff, and I would love for you to, consider mm-hmm. coming over here, joining the team.
Right. So Had you stayed in touch with him over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. He's always been a mentor to me, and so, the opportunity to work with him again was very appealing.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about, I guess, Chris Cox as an administrator and as a leader. What was his personality like?
Well, Chris is one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's just very analytical, a very, very sharp mind that really allows him to sort of cut through to the core of an issue quickly. He's also a very personally, just genuinely nice person who is, I wouldn't say he's the kind of person who's like a backslapper, that you might think of as a typical congressman, mm-hmm. But he's a genuinely nice person.
Right. Yeah. There were a lot of news articles from this period contrasting his personality with another, congressman at that time, Barney Franks, just in terms of, style, appearance, everything yeah. else. Was there any concern that that Congressman Cox might have trouble getting along with Congressman Franks?
No, it's funny. He and Barney actually have been friends in Congress, so they, knew each other, and perhaps friends is probably too strong, but, they certainly knew each other and were respected each other as roll call usually runs a annual, smartest members on the Hill article. And, he and Chris and Barney would often be, 1-2. And so, I think there was a mutual respect there that, made it easy for them to work together. And, the thing about Barney in particular is he's a very straightforward human being. He's a very straightforward legislator. And so if, even if you disagree, it doesn't have to be personal. And there's no subterfuge involved. It's, a clash of ideas, right. And you can do that.
Very businesslike. So. Yeah. Okay. So the Office of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs, what did that office do exactly?
Well, the idea was that the office was going to both provide the SEC's interaction with Congress, manage that relationship, and then also with sort of state and local governments as, issues arose, we'd be the point of contact for, those entities as well. And, the office was a small one and attached to the chairman's office, and so it was very much a, sort of direct 10th floor office, if that means anything. And we would work very closely with all the commissioner's offices because we really did view ourselves as representing the commission, not just the chairman. But, it's very a small office. I think we were at peak six folks and really had a dedication or focus on getting, providing Congress with the information that it needed to, make mm-hmm. financial regulatory policy.
Right. So you were in charge of, your office was in charge of answering queries from the Congress and things like that. Okay. About how much? What was the volume of correspondence with the Congress like? Was there a lot?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was an active relationship. I think that the 2002, financial scandals really, or 2000, 2001, 2002, really brought those issues to the fore, to Congress's attention, to a much broader swath of attention in Congress. And so it was one of those things that was of interest to more people than I think the SEC had been traditionally. So we would deal with a lot of questions and a lot of just sort of explaining how the securities laws worked, because at the end of the day, it was something that was suddenly of interest to a lot of members of Congress who didn't have a lot of experience with these issues. And so a huge part of our job simply was just sort of educating them on, well, this is the structure of what, the statute is, and this mm-hmm. is the structure of how the commission operates, so that mm-hmm. they could understand what we could and couldn't do in regards to problems that they had identified as priorities. And so, one of the old saws about the SEC is that it's a creature of Congress. Because we're created by Congress, because we've got a board that is has a statutory makeup, statutory balance, and that it's supposed to be somewhat independent of the of day-to-day direction from the White House. There's definitely a closer relationship between the SEC than there would necessarily be between, say, Congress and Treasury.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so the Office of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs. So were you also dealing with other branches of the government, with Treasury, Federal Reserve, other things like
no,
that?
No, the intergovernmental piece. I should say, yes, we were dealing with them. Okay. The intergovernmental piece was both the state and local stuff and then also sort of intra-governmental, dealing with state and Treasury and the Fed. And it was an interesting thing because there was a new responsibility that had been added back to the office. Apparently, that office had been the Office of Legislative Affairs for some period of time. And then prior to that, it had also been the Office of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs. And so part of what Chris wanted to do was to bring back that intergovernmental piece so that there was a focal point within the agency for our interactions with state and locals and then also with other agencies of other agencies of the government.
Right. One other question about that, just general question about working at the SEC. So at the SEC, as in a lot of different government agencies and organizations, there are career staff and there are people that just are going to be there for a couple of years and probably head somewhere else. Did you notice, a cultural distinction between the two within the organization, or did everybody work together pretty well?
No, it was, the thing about the SEC, it's a pretty small layer of people who are sort of politicals, if you will. And then you've got a larger, obviously a much larger body of the agency is career staff. But even those, even with the career staff, there was definitely sort of a, for a lot of people who were, going to be there for 3-4 years and then go into the private sector, whether that be, private sector law firms or private accounting, to go, to make use of their, the expertise they gained in government mm-hmm. In implementing the securities laws. And so, I think there's a healthy influx of new people, new ideas going on pretty constantly at the SEC. So it wasn't necessarily kind of place where there was just sort of a stodgy bureaucratic viewpoint, as much as there was always sort of a new influx of lawyers and accountants coming in from the private sector or going out to the private sector that brought in new perspectives and sort of, ground truth from the markets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I've got a big long list of issues to ask you about, and they're sort of divided into two categories, some having to do with the financial crisis, and then there's others that are non-financial crisis related. I'm going to start with the latter first, if that's all right.
Yeah.
First, appropriations. As I understand it, one of the big jobs of your office is to deal with Congress as regards SEC appropriations. Was that ever an issue? Were you did the SEC always get the budget it wanted?
Well, I didn't always get the budget it wanted, but we did pretty well in the appropriations process. Especially, since the financial scandals, there was a lot of interest in Congress in making sure the SEC had the resources it needed to do the job. And so when I got there, we had just sort of peaked budget-wise. So that there was a large influx of, had been over the past couple of years, large influx of funds that had allowed a lot of hiring, And really the task that I faced was looking at what made sense and what had been sort of overshooting. Because, you know, in response to any crisis, there's always a tendency to throw money at a problem. And then after a period of time, you can sort of assess, okay, this is what we actually needed to be doing as opposed to, you know, some of the stuff perhaps we don't need to be doing. And so, you know, basically the budget started to level off, which was, you know, a perfectly appropriate reaction to sort of what the needs were going forward.
So. Yeah. At various times, I guess, in the history of the SEC, there's been a push from within the organization to try to get Congress to allow the SEC to keep some of the money they take in, not just fees, but also disgorgements and things like that. Was that ever an issue while you were working there?
Well, you know, it was certainly something that, you know, several of the commissioners thought was a worthy idea. And, you know, there's always a delicate balance between being a member of the executive branch, being part of the executive branch. And, you know, obviously the budget is ultimately the president's budget request that goes up. And so it's not, you know, asking for an independent funding stream would have been something that would have required coordination with, you know, the executive, you know, with the White House. And I think that's, you know, probably not something that was... you know, likely to get a favorable reception.
So. At the White House level.
Yeah. But yeah, it was certainly something that was had been talked about, that folks had talked about over the years.
And, right. Yeah. You know. Didn't happen then. No. Okay. So one of the big issues that that the SEC was working on was municipal securities regulation. Yeah. What was the concern about municipal securities?
Well, you know, the fact is that it's a largely unregulated market at present, and there's a lot of potential for abuse there, and there have been some documented cases of abuse. And so the thrust of what Chairman Cox was interested in at the time was increasing transparency in that market because there's just so little information available to the average investor in municipal securities. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at ways that we could increase transparency, you know, both in the way that these municipalities presented their financial statements, but also what disclosures they were making to the public, you know, on that information. And so it was really just a matter of a significant in size market that was not getting adequate regulatory scrutiny because the statutory regime didn't allow for that.
Right, and of course the statutory regime specifically didn't allow the SEC to, I guess, to regulate certain aspects of the municipal market. Was there much pushback from either Congress or from the bonds community or from anyone else about efforts to regulate municipal securities?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there were limits to what actions the SEC could actually take, and so it was really a question of what we could do to educate Congress about the shortcomings in this area of regulation. And so in conversations, you know, there's definitely those members who were not convinced there was a significant problem there. Mm-hmm. And so it was an ongoing educational issue. And I think a lot of attention obviously shifted away from munis to, you know, the other segments of the financial market once, you know, Bear Stearns faces difficulties.
Right. So another of the perennial issues that the SEC deals with that came up during this time was the question of executive pay. Now, even as I understand it, even prior to the outbreak of the financial crisis, some people have been concerned about the level that executive salaries had been reaching and what implications that had for investors and for the economy. Was that something that the SEC was particularly interested in during the period?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of discussion about it, and particularly around the issue of say on pay, you know, shareholder resolutions. And, you know, the view the majority of the commission at the time took was that we needed to, you know, disclosure was the best, you know, medicine here, and that basically requiring, you know, the disclosure of these salaries was sufficient to allow investors to make informed decisions on that subject. But, yeah, there were definitely a lot of interest on the Hill in particular on requiring executive pay packages to be approved as part of you know, each year as part of the shareholders' annual annual votes. And so, you know, I think ultimately that ended up as part of Dodd-Frank. Right. And so, you know, there was a lot of, it wasn't a bolt out of the blue when it ended up in Dodd-Frank. Uh-huh. It had been something that had been under a lot of discussion for several years.
Would you characterize that as primarily a Democratic or Republican issue, or was it something that had support on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, it was primarily a Democratic issue. You know, it was one of those issues that, you know, people talk about boardroom versus Main Street kind of thing, and that was, it was really framed in a lot of ways that way. Okay. You know, as people start talking about CEO salaries being multiples of an average worker's and that sort of thing.
Right. Okay, so another big issue during this period, the implementation of SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley, and particularly Section 404, which had to do with accounting requirements, or auditing requirements, excuse me. So in May 2007, the SEC voted to relax Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley. Was this something that you spent a lot of time working on, or was that already decided when you came in?
No, it was definitely an issue where everyone was very focused on implementing 404. Because you had a lot of interest on the Hill, and there was a lot of interest from members on both sides who were getting, you know, complaints from, you know, from their constituents about the implications of this provision on them. The reality of 404 implementation was that it was just a very difficult thing to imagine, you know, a certain tier of public companies being able to implement the requirement successfully. And at the end of the day, it wasn't clear that the costs of implementing it were commensurate with the potential benefits. And so, you know, we would probably more than any other issue that I worked on while I was at the SEC, this got a lot of attention from the Hill. And again, because they got a lot of attention from people's constituents.
Yeah. Would you characterize the Hill's positions, I guess, as split into Republican and Democratic, or was it a little bit different?
Yeah, I mean, certainly most of the folks who were pushing for stricter implementation of 404 were on the Democratic side of the aisle. And, you know, most of the opponents were on the Republican side. But you definitely would hear concerns from both members of both parties. And you'd also hear sort of different things depending on whether you're in a public setting or if you're in a private one. You know, a lot of members who would push for strict implementation, a strict interpretation of 404 in public would in private say, no, no, we understand that you guys need to, you know, make some accommodations and that sort of thing. And so, you know, there's a bit of posturing involved in this sort of thing. Okay. That'd be shocking.
Yep.
Congress posturing.
Yep. Yes, I imagine that, Josh. So another thing that came up during this period, at various times from the media, from the Congress, there were charges that that the SEC was being more sympathetic to business than it than it usually was, or than that should be the case. And in fact, there were there was a hearing, I guess, in June 2007, in which all five SEC commissioners testified before the Financial Services Committee about this issue. Was this actually a problem for you in your day-to-day business? Or
no, it was an interesting perception. And I think it's one of those things that regardless of whether you have a what the facts are, you always end up with a Republican majority SEC is always accused of being too close to business, and a Democratic majority commission is always accused of being too anti-business. You know, Chairman Cox always made the you know, his favorite line in his speech has always started off was that SEC is the law enforcement agency. And so he very much viewed it as the job of the SEC to enforce the rules of the road. And then when you go out and look at making new regulations or reviewing old regulations, you certainly want to incorporate incorporate economic analysis, incorporate cost-benefit analysis, both as required by statute and as a matter of good policy, so that you do implement the laws in a way that is, you know, most efficient and least burdensome to the economy. Okay. So at the end of the day, the whole purpose of having the SEC is to ensure efficient capital markets. And if you don't have you know, and that has two elements. One is enforcing the rules so that there's not fraud, so that there's everyone feels like the market is on the level. But at the same time, efficiency requires that you, in fact, do things in a way that is least costly.
Right.
So, you know, it's the two elements of that efficient market are always have to be balanced, and it's you know, a decision that those five commissioners have to weigh on each decision that's brought before them.
So. Right. Yeah. So you mentioned that the SEC was Republican dominated at this time. It was 3-2 Republicans and Democrats. And then I guess in late 2007 and early 2008, both of the Democratic commissioners left the SEC completely by chance. Of course, it's not like they were forced out or anything like that. But there was no Republican coup going on. But was this a problem for you in dealing with Congress at all?
Well, I don't know if it was a problem so much as obviously the legitimacy of actions the commission might take. It's better to take these sorts of actions when you've got a full commission so that there's not the implication that, oh, you just snuck it through while you know, the commission was lacking its Democratic members.
Do you ever recall that coming up that someone said, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't act on this particular issue until you get some other commissioners confirmed?
You know, I do remember that coming up, and I can't remember what the specific issue was. Yeah. But I do remember, you know, there were staff on the Hill who would make that argument, usually because they were, you know, trying to delay action on a, you know, a regulation that they didn't think should go forward. But, you know, the fact is that Annette Nazareth and Laurel Campos were both had very strong relationships with the Hill. And so it was always an asset to have, you know, their perspectives on how we could approach issues with the Hill. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was definitely a loss to see them go. But, you know, we got, you know, two new commissioners that were high quality in replacement.
Yeah. Okay. So, as we mentioned earlier, when you started your position at the SEC, the subprime mortgage crisis was already starting to happen. Did you have any idea that there was going to be any sort of major financial crisis, or did any gut feeling about that?
No, a major financial crisis, no. I think everyone expected there was going to be some trouble in the housing markets, but that ultimately it would correct, the economy would work through it. I don't think anyone anticipated the depth of what we ended up having.
Right.
You know, I think one thing that is telling, though, in 2007, early 2007, Chairman Cox and the commissioners decided to set up a task force to focus on issues in the financial market and to coordinate the different divisions' work in this area. So it was prescient that they sort of figured out or at least identified that there was going to be an issue that was going to reach across a variety of the SEC's functions and really got that going early on.
Now, after that, or in regards to the subprime mortgage crisis, I guess in 2006, Congress had granted the SEC the authority to oversee the ratings agencies. What were you all doing in regards to the ratings agency during this period?
Yeah, at that period, the regulations to implement the Credit Rating Agency Reform Act hadn't gone into effect yet. And so the comment period was still open for a long period of time at the beginning of the crisis. And the regulations themselves went into effect, I want to say, maybe in August of 2007. That's about right. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, interestingly, the way the statute is set up, it really is a disclosure statute. It's not a, the SEC was explicitly prevented from providing any, you know, view or regulating in any way the way that the agents, that the NRSROs conducted their ratings. So it was a, really about setting up a disclosure regime. And we actually began a series of reviews pretty early on. Once the regulation had gone into effect, of an examination of those agencies' practices, so that we had sort of further information out there on how they were conducting their businesses.
Yeah, do you recall that the commissioners were fairly united about how they wanted to proceed with that?
Yeah, I mean, the statute was pretty clear. So, you know, this wasn't one of those areas where there was a great deal of discretion that the SEC had to exercise. There were certainly, I think, perhaps differences of opinion among the commissioners about what the law should say and whether, you know, there were expansions or sorry, not expansions, but amendments to the law merited. But, you know, I think there was pretty good unanimity on what the regulations that the SEC had control over, what they should say.
Okay. Do you recall the moment when you realized that well, actually the economy is heading towards a giant crisis and this is going to have huge implications for our agency?
You know, I think the you know, I wasn't prescient on this. Bear Stearns, you know, I think that that weekend really was a an eye-opener.
This was March 2008. Can you tell me a little bit about how you experienced that particular weekend?
Yeah, well, you know, I left work on, you know, Friday afternoon, and there, you know, being in legislative affairs, on, you know, we weren't in the, you know, we need to operate, we need to figure out how to resolve this institution. But, you know, someone had sent me an email saying, hey, you know, stick by your BlackBerry, there's some stuff going on here. And so it was one of those issues that, you know, over the weekend, I just sort of kept monitoring emails, had a couple of conversations with the chairman, because obviously the Hill was interested in what was going on.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't entirely clear, frankly, what was going to be happening. You know, the resolution of, or the arrangement that was made to sell Bayer really highlighted the difficulty of, the, you know, these highly complex, interconnected investment banks that didn't have a guaranteed source of funding, weren't eligible for funding through the Federal Reserve window, and yet the failure of them could have broad-reaching implications for both financial stability and for the economy.
Right.
And so it really sort of opened up a set of issues that wasn't new, but really brought them into to sharp focus. Because we've been thinking or been discussing with Congress a lot over the previous 5-6 months, the regulatory regime that the SEC administered, called the Consolidated Supervised Entities Program, that was overseeing the five major investment banks. And so there have been a lot of scrutiny, a lot of attention given to the question of this regulatory regime, whether it needed a statutory basis, whether it was adequate to the task. And so we've been doing a lot of thinking on that, but I think Bayer really brought into sharp focus the these issues.
Now, in the weeks and months that followed, Chris Cox came under a little bit of criticism. Actually, he was sort of seen as having taken a backseat role during this period, I think was the term that some people used. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Well, it's a difficult thing. You know, when I go back to what he always liked to start his speeches with, that the SEC is a law enforcement agency. And so the SEC is in an awkward position as both the regulator of Bear Stearns and then also as the regulator of the financial markets generally, and someone who could potentially be charged with bringing charges against you know, people involved in transactions or against the firms for past practices. And so there was always an inherent tension there, an attention that I think people ultimately decided was untenable.
Mm-hmm.
Once the CSE program was ended, and you know, the regulation, and basically the idea of sort of having these large independent investment banks that weren't subject to you know, the bank regulatory regime, sort of was done away with.
Right.
So there's just sort of, at the end of the day, an irreconcilable tension.
Yep. Did you notice a change in the tone of, I guess, of comments coming from the Hill, or letters, phone calls?
Oh, certainly.
Like,
I mean,
after Bear Stearns.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Hill was much more critical of the SEC's performance afterwards. There's no question about that. You know, and that's to be expected. At the end of the day, when things don't go well, Congress has every right to be critical about that and to ask questions of, you know, why is it that things went poorly.
Okay. So after the Bear Stearns debacle, there were a couple of different plans that were floated for reforming the system of financial regulation. One came from the SEC. One came from the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve. And that one in particular, I think, urged combining the SEC with the CFTC and taking some other drastic steps. Do you recall communicating with the Hill about these different plans?
Yeah, certainly. You know, the Hill made clear, you know, this was 2008, and so the Hill made clear none of this was going to happen before the election. And there's a lot of, you know, politics between SEC, CFTC on the Hill just because of the split jurisdiction. You know, going back to what we were discussing earlier as far as the creation of the Financial Services Committee, one, you know, glaring element that was left out of the new Financial Services Committee was jurisdiction over the CFTC, which remained with the Agriculture Committee, and there was a similar split up on the Senate side. And so, you know, there's always a lot of commissions or recommendations that come out for consolidating the financial regulatory structure, and it generally founders on these difficulties of dealing with jurisdictions and difficulties dealing with different missions. Because at the end of the day, you look at banking regulators, for instance, they have a prudential responsibility or a prudential approach, while the market regulators are much more in the enforcement mode, much more on the, hands off, require disclosure, establish clear rules of the road, and then enforce them, as opposed to, working with institutions and trying to convince and trying to ensure that they're being run in a prudent manner. So we have a very fragmented system, as we were discussing earlier, but the fragmentation also reflects a variety of different perspectives on the issues engaged in the financial services industry, and so it's just it's probably not optimal, but it is what it is, I guess.
Did you hear a lot of different or calls perhaps from the Hill for to reinstate the the separation between investment and commercial banking?
Glass-Steagall. I'm trying to think back. I mean, there was. I think a lot of people viewed that as. Horses out of the barn. The reality that U.S. financial institutions were engaged in a variety of financial services transactions, a variety of lines of business, was just sort of seen as difficult to it was going to be next to impossible to sort of untangle. Right. And there was also issues of sort of the competitiveness of U.S. businesses if you did that, where you sort of encouraged them to move offshore where those restrictions had never been in place.
Right.
I think if you look back at the crisis, I don't think there's a lot of evidence that Glass-Steagall was the issue, because you had both banks and non-bank financial institutions in trouble. You had insurance companies in trouble. I mean, it really was a very broad, cross-section of the financial market that was the financial sector that was troubled, and it wasn't necessarily the issue of banks making loans to affiliated institutions that were unsound that was at issue.
Okay. Now, in July 2008, you were still at the SEC, and Fannie and Freddie were taken into federal conservatorship.
Yep.
Do you recall the SEC working on that very much at that time, or was that something happening separately?
Yeah, that was something happening separately. Obviously, the FCC was on the board of the new Financial Housing Finance Agency, the new regulator that was finally put into place in 2008. But, the reality was that it was relatively quickly after FHFA was set up that the decision was made that they needed to be taken into conservatorship. And again, the SEC in its role as sort of the market enforcer, the market regulator, has to maintain a somewhat of a hands-off approach to these things because, as we were discussing earlier, Fannie had, violated the securities laws, not several years before. And so there's definitely the potential for other violations to be in place, and so the SEC necessarily has to be a third party to this sort of
right.
thing. It can't be a
All right. So in August 2008, you left the SEC. What did you end up doing?
Oh, I decided to go to grad school. So I went off to Johns Hopkins International Affairs School and went and got a master's.
Okay. Were you working on financial stuff at all?
Slice has more of a focus on international economic issues. So, I spent, and obviously it was sort of the heart of the financial crisis. There was obviously a lot of discussion of international monetary policy and all the rest. So, it was a fascinating time to be on the sidelines, sort of watching all the players and be able to sort of understand what the motivations were, that sort of thing. But
okay. And then in August 2010, you went back to work on the Hill, right? Mm-hmm. And where were you working there?
Worked for the House Budget Committee.
Okay.
So I joined the staff in, as you said, in August 2010 or maybe July. Sometime in 2010, that summer of 2010. And then was handling defense issues and international affairs issues, and then eventually became the policy director for the committee.
Okay. Yeah. And now you're working as a deputy policy director for the Romney campaign.
Yeah.
Do you think that financial regulation is going to play a role in the election this fall?
Absolutely. I mean, Governor Romney has made a point of discussing the uncertainty and sort of the burden that Dodd-Frank has placed on the economy. And so part of his program is repealing Dodd-Frank. And he was just talking about that, in fact, the other day.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, do you have any final thoughts to share with us before we wrap up?
No, I think this was a very interesting set of issues to go back over. It's been a while since I've given this much thought to some of this stuff. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.